The Arthropod. The Arthropod is the home for the wonderful, weird, wacky world of insects. Hosted by Jonathan Larson, Jody Green, and Michael Scavarla.
In 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Welcome back, everybody, to Arthropod, your entomology podcast. I am one of your hosts for the day. They call me Jonathan Larson, and I work for the University of Kentucky.
They call me Jody Green. I work for the University of Nebraska-Lincoln.
I can't keep a straight face. I'm Michael Scavarla with Penn State University.
And we are very excited to be joining you again in your earbuds, in your headphones, and talking about bugs and bug-related things. Today, we have a very special episode produced by our very own Mike Scavarla. He is going to be talking to us about, you want to set it up? Like, I'm going to softball it to you here.
Yeah, sure. Send me that softball. I made a bat swinging motion that nobody
look
can
at,
see.
Look at that Babe Ruth-like form.
We are going to talk about carnivorous plants. So I guess behind the scenes of Arthropod, we all try to do at least one kind of written scripted show every year. I took that to an extreme last year with the Napoleon series. Yeah, that's an appropriate laugh. Jonathan more recently did it with his Truvolo's Bad Idea and Spongy Moth episodes. So I'm up again, and initially this was supposed to be an episode about Rocky Mountain locusts, because that's another somewhat obsession of mine, but I've been absolutely hammered with work, and I couldn't read the books that I needed to. And recently, I have gotten back into growing carnivorous plants. I grew them in high school and then left for college, and they are not necessarily easy to raise, and all of my plants died out, and I haven't really been into it for the last 15 years or so. And so this year I got a little bit of birthday money from my grandma, because she is amazing. And at 91 still gives me birthday money.
That's and cute. So, I like it.
Right.
Yeah, and that's a good grandma.
It is. I love her very much. And so I thought, I've got some extra money that nobody is going to tell me I can't spend on whatever the heck I want. And it's birthday money. It should be something frivolous. And so I bought some carnivorous plants, because that's what I wanted to buy. And I have spent a couple minutes every day, like going out, looking at my plants, like, where have the leaves grown? Have they grown at all? Have they caught any bugs? And it's been really fun. And so when I realized I couldn't write about Rocky Mountain locusts because I didn't have time to read, I thought, well, what else can I do? Like, with less preparation. And it turns out I picked carnivorous plants because I already know a lot about the subject. It turns out I ended up still doing a lot of reading for it to make sure I got everything correct. So it probably was just as much or more work anyhow in the long run. But anyway, it's a long setup. Today,
the perfect setup.
We're going to talk about carnivorous plants.
So it's like a hobby for you. It's like a relaxing thing to look at these plants.
It is. I really enjoy it. I've got some now on my windowsill inside, and I've got two miniature bog gardens outside in my vegetable garden because it has a fence and I don't want the dogs or the kids going in and tearing my plants up. So I made some space for them out there.
So Jody, you like to sit in your pollinator garden and you kind of sit in amongst life and they flit around. Am I remembering that?
Right? Yep.
So you kind of like celebrate the interaction between plant and bee.
I celebrate whatever I'm seeing out there, because okay. I try not to interfere. Like, I feel like if I'm too in the way, then things won't land, right? So I'm kind of stooped down, just sitting around.
Very much a passive observer, the watcher kind of thing. Mike wants to go sit in his garden of death where the bugs are devoured by plants.
All the circle of life, right, Mike?
Yeah, that's a fair assessment.
Okay.
My sundews in particular are ravaging the small fly population in my garden. So
this sounds exciting. It seems like maybe we're going on a deep dive. We're going to be talking about a lot of different historical, like, is Napoleon going to get in here again, or?
No, I don't think so. Maybe. So I started writing, and similar to the Napoleon series, I came up to my word count limit and was not done. So I've broken this topic into two episodes. So today we're going to talk about kind of the background of carnivorous plants, like what exactly is a carnivorous plant and where do they grow just in general, and then talk through some of the different groups there are, because carnivory has arisen multiple times within plants. And then next week we'll polish off talking about the different groups of carnivorous plants and maybe round it out with some other interesting things.
Cool. Now, up front, we do want to say that we know podcasting is inherently an auditory medium, but Mike is going to be talking about some visual descriptions, and he has some photographs that he wants to share, right?
Yeah, as always, we'll have the blog with lots of photos, and if you're having trouble picturing some of the things that I'm talking about, I'll have copious amounts of photos there that you can look at. I will try to describe what these things look like and how the traps operate, but you know, it is trying to convert a visual thing into an audio format. And if that isn't working for you, go see our visual supplements.
Yes, I think that you can play a game with yourself. Take Mike's words and build a visual image in your mind, and then go to arthro-pod.blogspot.com and look at the actual show notes and see how close or how far away you were constructing the carnivorous plant in your head.
Again, that's arthro- dash. Ah! I screwed it up. You just said it.
Don't forget the dash.
arthro-pod.blogspot.com.
That's the one.
The one and only, in fact.
With that, I'm going to kind of get out of the way now. Like, I've done my editor-in-chief introduction business here, and I'm gonna turn the mic over to Mike.
Tell me about these plants.
Carnivorous plants have fascinated scientists for more than a century. Darwin famously spent 18 years studying sundews and other carnivorous plants before publishing a book on the subject, Insectivorous Plants, aptly named. But they are also some of the most familiar plants to a general audience. Almost anyone from any background can identify a Venus flytrap and tell you that it eats insects. They're as identifiable as roses or oak trees and can be purchased at many of the places that sell horticultural plants. They even make appearances, albeit highly exaggerated, in popular culture. Audrey 2 from Little Shop of Horrors and the piranha plants from the Mario video games are some very good examples of this.
Also Pokemon.
Also Pokemon.
Picture Bell.
And Weepin' Bell.
Yeah. Carnivine.
Oh, that's a good one. I didn't even think about Pokemon. Yeah. So they're there as well.
Yep. Piranha plant is a good one, though. I like that.
Well, that's just where I go. Mario is, I guess, I didn't realize that Bellsprout was a carnivorous plant when I played through the first Pokemon. So it didn't initially occur to me.
But now it's your favorite one, is what you're saying.
I do like them. I should have known with Acid Splash.
Yes, you should have.
It's easy to see why carnivorous plants are fascinating. Plants are supposed to be eaten and shouldn't eat things themselves. That's weird. It's the natural order turned upside down. But this superficial familiarity is often the limit of most people's knowledge of carnivorous plants. Venus flytraps exist and eat bugs. End of story. Which is a shame, because there's a diversity of growth forms and trapping mechanisms and life histories that are all strange and interesting. So today, and actually next episode as well, we're going to dive into some of these strange and interesting bits about carnivorous plants. There are many plants that trap insects, but only a few of them eat them. Of the approximately 374,000 species of plants that have been described, only around 580, or 0.16%, are carnivorous. Tomatoes, potatoes, tobacco, and other solanaceous plants are covered in sticky hairs that capture and kill small insects. So are geraniums and a multitude of other plants. Some of these sticky plants excrete protease that breaks down insects, and some of the resulting nutrients are absorbed by plants. But they're not carnivorous. So how do we define carnivory in plant, the quote-unquote carnivorous syndrome, as it's sometimes called, and draw a distinction between those plants that eat insects versus those that just incidentally capture them? Five general characteristics have been agreed upon in the scientific literature. which Ellison and Adamek, in the introduction of their book, Carnivorous Plants, Physiology, Ecology, and Evolution, list as 1, capturing or trapping prey in specialized, usually attractive traps. 2, killing the captured prey. 3, digesting the prey. 4, absorption of the metabolites or nutrients from the killed and digested prey. And 5, use of the metabolites for plant growth and development. Solanaceous plants fulfill the first 4 of these characteristics by capturing, killing, and digesting small insects and absorbing the resulting nutrients. However, because they grow in nutrient-rich soils, the vast majority of the nutrients solanaceous plants use for growth are absorbed via the roots and not derived from captured insects, so they aren't carnivorous. Within truly carnivorous plants, that is, those plants that fulfill all 5 characteristics I just mentioned, carnivory really exists on a spectrum. Some plants can grow without the nutrient input from captured insects, but grow more slowly than if they were to capture insects. Others can grow, but produce fewer or non-viable seeds. Others require insect-derived nutrients for growth and cannot survive long-term without them. Some plants grow carnivorous structures only during certain seasons, but produce non-carnivorous leaves during other seasons. Still, other species grow carnivorous structures only during certain life stages. Some plants that have carnivorous ancestors have even reverted to non-carnivory and have repurposed specialized traps for catching rodent or bat droppings other than catching insects. Carnivory has evolved at least 10 and possibly 12 separate times, and there are currently more than 580 species and 19 genera that are considered carnivorous. So, quote unquote, carnivorous plants are not a single related group or monophyletic lineage, but rather a collection of unrelated plants that have all evolved a similar set of characteristics. But what is it that drives plants to evolve the carnivorous syndrome, and why is there a spectrum of carnivory within the plants that become carnivorous? Like most systems, the answer is complex and variable, but it can be simplified to the interplay between the amount of light, water, and nutrients available, competition from co-occurring plants, and the cost and benefit of carnivory is modifying leaves to capture insects reduces the photosynthetic potential of those leaves, and producing digestive chemicals to process captured insects is an energetically expensive process that uses resources that could otherwise be used to grow additional leaves. So in most environments, the costs of carnivory are not outweighed by the benefits of increased nutrient availability. For example, in nutrient-rich soils, plants don't need to capture insects for additional nutrition, and doing so would not outweigh the cost of decreased photosynthesis. Similarly, in low-light environments, plants can't sacrifice leaf area and photosynthetic potential to increase nutrient acquisition via prey capture. In both cases, doing so would mean being outcompeted by non-carnivorous plants that maximize photosynthetic potential over nutrient acquisition. So in most environments, it makes sense to be a non-carnivorous plant. So where do carnivorous plants occur? Where do the benefits of carnivory outweigh the costs? In habitats with high light availability to offset the decreased photosynthetic potential of modified leaves. In habitats which lack nutrients to increase the benefits of capturing prey for nutrients. And in habitats with few to no non-carnivorous competitors that can outgrow plants investing in carnivorous structures. So, John and Jody, what environments do you think fulfill these requirements of high light and low nutrients with few competitors?
The swamp.
Yes, swamps are an excellent example of places that carnivorous plants grow. Any other ideas? Because there's a couple.
Ohio.
There are carnivorous plants in Ohio, but Ohio in particular doesn't make for carnivorous plants. So
right. It's a dark land. Jody, what's your guess?
What about?
I've got the easy one.
It's the easy one. Is there a jungle?
They can grow in the jungle. So temperate wetlands, including bogs, seeps, marshes, swamps, marls, fens, wet savannas, wet pine forests, wet heathlands, and sometimes the margins of pools, lakes, and streams. In these areas, the water leaches out the nutrients, and they often have low pH, which prevents the breakdown of organic material. In some places in temperate wetlands, carnivorous plants are also dependent on cyclical fire regimes to keep down competitive plants. So if the fires stop for too long, the carnivorous plants get overgrown. In the Mediterranean area, there are seasonal wetlands, and these have variable wet and dry seasons. And in these places, the substrate is often an inorganic material that lacks nutrients. So it's very rocky. And that lack of abundant plant material in these rocky areas precludes buildup of organic material. And then when it does rain, all of that organic material gets washed away. Tropical lowland swamps have similar processes to temperate wetlands, and the substrate is often composed of inorganic materials that lack nutrients. Tropical lowland forests, so the jungle, are often heavily shaded. So plants in these areas really buck the trend of needing high sunlight. There are very few carnivorous plants in this type of habitat, although they do exist. Many of the ones that do exist in this kind of habitat are partly evolved away from carnivory. So they're investing more in photosynthetic structures and less in capturing insects. And the ground that they're found in is generally acidic, waterlogged substrate with little organic material. So it's often loose pebbles that overlie clay or sand that help keep the water in. A few carnivorous plants in tropical lowland forests are found on moss-covered rocks, though. Tropical highlands, these are extreme environments. So they're generally areas that are above 1,000 meters in the tropics. They often have extreme temperature swings between 6 degrees Celsius at night and 25 Celsius during the day. So about 40 degrees Fahrenheit to 80 to 85 degrees Fahrenheit during the day. They have a lot of morning fog, but little cloud cover, so they aren't protected from solar radiation, really. In soils, if they're present in these areas, are often leached because there's so much water. There's just very few nutrients in the soil. There are some carnivorous plants that grow as epiphytes, so growing on trees. There are some carnivorous plants that grow in aquatic habitats as aquatic plants. They generally like slightly acidic, nutrient-poor waters that have high light and CO2 levels. So bogs that have standing water are a great example of this, but they'll also occur in lakes, river backwaters, drainage ditches, anywhere else that's kind of acidic, nutrient-poor, not a lot of competition from other aquatic plants. And then finally, lithophytic habitats. So these are plants that grow on bare stone where there's usually a constant supply of water. So think of like a wet cliff face where there's no soil there, but it's maybe got some drips of water coming down off the top of the cliff. Carnivorous plants really like to grow in those kind of habitats because there's no nutrients, very little competition.
When you describe all these different spots, not only does it sound like a place where nutrients kind of come in big bursts and then go away or not present at all. They also sound very buggy for the most part. They sound like places where lots of little flies are going to be buzzing around, perhaps.
Is that enough? Lots of mosquitoes, especially in aquatic habitats, aquatic flies. They could definitely have lots of insects in them.
Interesting. Maybe they should use those as a resource.
Maybe they should. That's a really, like all these little protein packs flying around. That's a great idea. I should take it up with the plants.
Almost like self-fertilizing.
Because carnivorous plants are unrelated, a number of different trapping mechanisms to capture prey have evolved. Some of these mechanisms have evolved only once, while others have evolved independently multiple times in different lineages using different parts of the plants, a phenomenon called convergent evolution. These trap types can be broken down into a few broad categories, including pitfall traps, flypaper traps, snap traps, bladder traps, lobster pot traps, and combination traps that combine two of the above types. I'll go into more details about the specifics of each trap when we talk about the different groups of carnivorous plants in a moment, but I want to give a summary of the trap types first, since some generalizations can be made across groups. Pitfall traps, some of which are also collectively called pitcher plants, are hollow structures that contain liquid that trap insects that fall into them. This trap type has evolved independently at least 6 times across 4 orders of plants, so the structures that comprise the traps and how they are formed are diverse. Most secrete lures, including nectar or floral smells, to attract prey. Some even lace their nectar with coenine, a toxic substance in poison hemlock that killed Socrates, which intoxicates the prey before they fall into the trap. Most pitfall traps are lined with downward-pointing hairs or a flaky wax layer, which help prevent prey from climbing out of the traps. A few traps have evolved overhanging lids or bulbous structures with clear membranes that allow light to shine through, so that when insects arrive at the bait, they think that they can fly through the windows and get confused and worn out trying to escape through these false exits. Most pitcher plants secrete the trap fluid and digestive enzymes, while others collect rainwater and rely on mutualist insects and bacteria to break down and partially digest captured prey. Sticky traps, which are also referred to as adhesive or flypaper traps, ensnare prey using sticky mucus. Sticky traps are one of the easiest forms of carnivory to evolve, since sticky trichomes already exist in many plant groups, so it's not surprising that sticky traps have evolved independently 6 or 7 times in 7 genera across 4 plant orders. Similar to pitfall traps, most sticky traps secrete their own digestive fluids, although one notable exception relies on mutualistic assassin bugs that feed on captured insects and then defecate on the plant. Most sticky trap plants are sessile, but some are capable of dramatic movement over a period of a few hours where the leaves curl around captured prey to aid in prey retention and digestion. Snap traps consist of 2 lobes that close quickly around prey after being triggered. Unlike the slower movement of sticky traps, snap traps can close within a second, a dramatic feat for plants. Venus fly traps are the classic example of snap traps, but the closely related water wheel plant also possesses this trap type. Because of their complexity, snap traps have evolved only once, almost certainly from sticky trap ancestors that lost their sticky trichomes after faster trap speeds evolved. Combination traps combine 2 of the above trap types and are relatively rare. Drosera glandulagera is primarily a sticky trap plant like other Drosera, the sundews. However, unlike related species, it has specialized tentacles that surround the sticky trap that snap up and fling prey into the sticky tentacles. And so this really extends the trap surface because insects that are walking by the trap, they are not touching the sticky glands, but if they touch these triggers, they get flung into the sticky glands. Other examples of combination traps include a few species of tropical pitcher plants, such as Nepenthes inermis and Nepenthes jambon. Most Nepenthes are pitcher plants, but these species also excrete a sticky mucus that traps insects above the digestive liquid, so they are sticky pitcher plants. Bladder traps are complex structures that have only evolved once in the genus Utricularia, the bladder worts. Bladder traps consist of a bladder or sac that has a lid that seals it. When sealed, the bladders pump ions out of the interior of the trap and water follows via osmosis, which in turn creates a partial vacuum on the inside of the trap. Then, when a small prey item triggers the trap, something like a daphnia in water or small nematodes in soil, the lid opens and the vacuum sucks the prey into the trap. Because they suck prey in using a vacuum, the trap is incredibly fast. Lobster pot traps are another highly specialized trap type that has only evolved once in the genus Genlesia, or perhaps twice depending on how you define the trap. Genlesia traps consist of highly modified leaves, which are twisted into a spiral helix and grow underground. The helix has small openings along the length that are easy for small organisms like protozoa to enter. However, backward-facing hairs inside the spiral prevent the trap prey from backing out, so they are forced to move towards a stomach or digestive chamber where they are captured and digested. The other potential lobster trap is a species of American pitcher plant, Sarracenia citicina, which are commonly known as the parrot pitcher plant. Most Sarracenia are upright pitfall traps and catch flying insects. Parrot pitcher plants, on the other hand, are recumbent and lie nearly horizontal on the ground and primarily catch ground-dwelling arthropods like beetles and spiders. While all pitcher plants have downward-facing hairs that help prevent prey from escaping, parrot pitcher plants have taken it to an extreme and are almost fuzzy inside with hairs so that prey that enters can't back out again. Now that we've covered some of the general basics about carnivorous plants, let's look at some of the different groups more specifically. Some of the groups are related and some aren't, so I'll move through the different groups phylogenetically so it's easier to connect the evolution of related groups, even when they have very different trap structures and live in different habitats. So first up are the monocots, which is a large group that includes plants such as grasses, bamboos, sedges, and orchids, and bromeliads. John and Jody, are you familiar with bromeliads in general? Have you heard of them before?
Yes. Isn't that what a pineapple is?
Yes.
Right. And it's like a hard plant that collects a lot of water. So as, you know, urban entomologists, when people water them, they collect water and sometimes flies will breed in there and they're kind of like a pest habitat.
Perfect. Do you, I don't imagine you have lots of problems with bromeliads in Nebraska.
I've seen them in actually restaurants, and that's when I will use them as a photo in my presentation about pests in food handling facilities and stuff like that.
That is really cool and something I never would have considered. I'm going to have to think about that now. That's really cool. So the family Bromeliaceae, the bromeliads, is rather large with 75 genera and 3,590 species, all but one of which are native to the American tropics and subtropics. There's one species that has made it over to Africa. Spanish moss in the American Southeast and pineapples are likely two of the species that people are familiar with. With so many species, there are a variety of growth forms, but most species grow as a rosette of leaves around a circular point. Most species grow as epiphytes on trees and collect rainwater, which are known as phytotelmata, and serve as important habitats for a multitude of rainforest species such as frogs, aquatic insects, and crabs. Since so many species collect and store water, it may be a bit surprising that only two or three unrelated species have evolved to carnivory, and that we've only conclusively shown they're carnivorous in the last few decades. However, many epiphytic species grow under the shade of the forest canopy, so the trade-off between carnivory and photosynthesis for most bromeliads is not worth it. Catatopsis burtoniana and Burkina reducta, the two confirmed carnivorous bromeliads, both occur in environments with high sun exposure like you'd expect for carnivorous plants. Catopsis ranges from Florida south to Brazil and grows in an epiphyte on the uppermost branches of the canopy that are exposed to full sun. Burkina is a terrestrial species with a more limited distribution that grows in the open rocky cerrados or high elevation tropical savannas in northern Brazil, Venezuela, and Colombia, where soil is thin and low in nutrients and there is less competition from other plants. Because most bromeliads already have a growth form that traps water, including both Catopsis and Burkina, the two species simply made it easier to trap insects by evolving thicker, dustier wax on the leaves that gums up insect tarsi and makes them slip more frequently into the water caught by the leaves. The wax also reflects UV, which helps attract potential pollinators and other insects. Both Catopsis and, as far as I can tell, Burkina lack digestive enzymes, so rely on mutualists that live in the phytotelmata to break down captured prey. However, both have specialized glands to absorb the nutrients from the water once they are released by these mutualists. The only other carnivorous monocot is Western False Asphodel, which grows in the Pacific Northwest in nutrient-poor environments along stream banks and bogs with well-known carnivorous sundews and butterworts. The leaves are around 6 inches in height and look rather like a lily. The flower stem is longer, 6 inches to a foot in height, and rather thick compared to the size of the leaves. The flower stem is covered in trichomes and acts as a sticky trap, which is unlike other sticky trap carnivores that usually try to keep their flowers away from their traps so as not to catch potential pollinators. However, the glue of Western False Asphodel is rather weak, so is best at trapping small insects like fungus gnats and entangling pollinators, and it's not an issue. Interestingly, the carnivorous nature of the species was only determined in 2021. Previous genetic work had shown that Western False Asphodel lacks an NDH gene that regulates and fine-tunes photosynthesis, among other things. This gene is missing in some butterworts, bladderworts, and Janlisia, but it is an otherwise rare deletion in non-carnivorous plants. Based on this information, a team from the University of British Columbia and the University of Wisconsin-Madison fed plants vinegar flies that were isotopically labeled with nitrogen-15 and found that up to 64% of the nitrogen in leaves was derived from prey captured the previous year. This level of nitrogen is on par with sundews growing in the same environment. Moving from the monocots to the dicots, the first clade where carnivorous plants occur are the rosids, which includes around 70,000 species or one quarter of all known flowering plants. Within the rosids, there is only a single carnivorous plant, the Albany pitcher plant, Cephalotus follicularis. Based on the common name, where do you think the Albany pitcher plant occurs?
Albania.
Not a bad idea. Jody, do you have an idea?
Albany. I said Ohio at first.
Yeah, she brought it back.
She did bring it back. Neither of those. I was kind of hoping you were going to do the Simpsons steamed hams.
No, it's more of a Utica kind of
thing. They're all in upstate New York. Cephalotus inhabits a small 400-kilometer stretch of extreme southwest Australia and is named after Albany, Western Australia.
That's not even fair. Curse you, colonialism.
Right? They are small, herbaceous plants that grow up to 7 inches tall, with the height mostly accounted for by the pitchers themselves. Cephalotus are pitcher plants, and the pitchers are cup or shoe-shaped and covered by a lid, so it looks like a yawning mouth. At least I think it looks like a yawning mouth. The exterior of the pitchers are green but turn dark red or purple in direct sunlight. The lid has fenestra or light windows that make the trap opening look really bright in contrast to the dark pitcher, and this helps trick insects into flying into the open mouth. The opening of the pitcher has a peristome or rim, which has inward and downward facing spines or teeth that also help keep insects from escaping the trap once they enter it. The climate where Cephalotus grows is Mediterranean, with hot summer days and cool nights, and cool to cold winters, and they occur from sea level to around 200 meters in elevation. Cephalotus grow in wetlands and bogs, roadside ditches and lakesides, usually in peaty or acidic soil with low nutrients. They prefer areas that have a constant supply of water but are somewhat tolerant of drier conditions as well. Albany pitcher plants usually grow in exposed locations or among other low-growing herbs. However, they are sometimes found in shade overgrown by trees or other tall plants. In these situations, the pitchers disappear and the plants grow only non-carnivorous leaves. Shaded plants do not put up flowers or reproduce sexually, but can wait for years until a fire or some other event clears away the trees and vegetation that shades them, after which time they will put out new pitchers and flowers. The inquilines associated with Albany pitcher plants have not been well studied, although there is a wingless micropezid fly whose larvae are only known to occur in the pitchers. The adult flies have been found in fairly dry sites, so may only inhabit plants that grow on the drier side of the spectrum of the habitats that Cephalotus occupy. The adult flies are also wingless, so in order to get from one population of pitcher plants to the other, they have to crawl and they can't fly. Unfortunately, because Albany pitcher plants inhabit a small range and have narrow habitat requirements, they're at risk due to habitat destruction. The ICUN lists them as vulnerable, although Australia does not recognize them as threatened in any way. They're also threatened by collecting for the horticultural trade. The species is slow growing, so there is a premium for large plants that are sometimes taken from the wild. It's also likely that large mature plants produce most of the seeds that keep populations stable, so removing the few large plants can threaten an entire population. However, the plant is cultivated widely and grows easily from seed and leaf cuttings, so the threat from horticultural trade has lessened in recent years as we've really figured out how to grow this thing in culture. Albany pitcher plants are also threatened by fire suppression efforts, which allows tall vegetation to grow over the plants, which eventually die out due to lack of reproduction. Finally, because the micropezid that lives in the pitchers is found only on the drier sites and can't fly, it may be more threatened than the pitcher plants themselves, since it can only inhabit a subset of the habitats that the plants inhabit. Next, we come to the DNDD clade, which is the first group of carnivorous plants that contains a plethora of related species. Classifications differ, so this group is either considered as a monophyletic order Nepenthales, which is sister to the plant order Caryophylles and contains mostly carnivorous species, or is a lower taxon that is subsumed within Caryophylles. I'm not a botanist, and I don't really have an opinion on which is correct, except to say that either these carnivores are somehow closely related to a diverse group that includes cacti, carnations, amaranths, or beets, either sister to those groups or embedded within it. DNDD and the DNDD clade refers to the families of carnivorous plants that make up the group, Droseraceae, Nepenthaceae, Drosophilaceae, and Dinocophilaceae. Carnivory is the basal condition in this group and is thought to have arisen sometime around 85.6 million years ago, or around 20 million years before the dinosaurs went extinct, when the first major split between this group occurred, with Drosseraceae Nepenthaceae on one side of the tree and Drosophilaceae and Dinocophilaceae on the other. We're going to start by looking at the Nepenthaceae, which includes a single genus, Nepenthes. Nepenthes are usually called tropical pitcher plants or just called by the genus name Nepenthes, although a more colorful name used, especially in older literature, is monkey cups. The name Nepenthes was coined by Linnaeus and refers to Nepenthe, the mythical drug in the Odyssey, which banishes sorrow, because he wrote, quote, "If this is not Helen's Nepenthe, it certainly will be for all botanists. What botanist would not be filled with admiration if, after a long voyage, he should find this wonderful plant? In his astonishment, past ills will be forgotten when beholding this admirable work of the creator," unquote. When the plants are seen, it's easy to understand why. Wait, Linnaeus... What?
Is that in The Raven too?
Maybe. Do you know the bit from The Raven? Can you quote it?
Nepenthe, release me from my sorrow.
That sounds like it certainly would be. That would callback to the Odyssey then.
Okay. I'd have to reread The Raven. I don't have it quite memorized. But
do you want me to pause it and cut the pause out so you can sound smarter on the audio?
No. We don't want to pretend to be smart. Heaven forfend. It rang a bell with me.
No, that's really cool. I don't recall The Raven that well to remember it, so I'm going to have to go reread it. That's really neat, and now I'm glad you've made that connection for us. When the plants are seen, it's easy to understand why Linnaeus was so enthralled. Nepenthes grow as small shrubs or vines. A few mature as small rosettes on the ground, but others grow up to vines up to 40 meters in length. The leaves, which alternate up the stem, are oblong, and the midrib extends from the tip of each leaf to form a tendril that expands into a single pitcher. Pitchers vary in morphology. Most have lids that shield them from rainwater, but in a few species, the lids are upturned or very small, so the pitchers are open to rain. Most pitchers are tall and relatively thin and have a constricted waist, although some have been greatly expanded and are toilet-shaped. Most species have different morphologically variable lower and upper pitchers, which likely catch different prey. Nepenthes are amongst the most diverse groups of carnivorous plants, with around 170 described species and new species being described regularly. They range throughout the Old World tropics, especially in Indonesia, Malaysia, and the Philippines. Around half of all described species are endemic to the islands of Borneo and Sumatra, with a few species ranging as far as Madagascar, India and Sri Lanka, Northern Australia, and New Caledonia. Tropical pitcher plants can be divided into lowland and highland species, with lowland species living below 1,000 meters in elevation and experiencing permanently warm tropical conditions, and highland species above 1,000 meters experiencing colder, often wetter environments that have daily temperature fluctuations that can get downright cold at night. Despite the common name tropical pitcher plant, which conjures up images of heat and humidity, the majority of species are in the highland group and regularly experience cold temperatures. This difference between highland and lowland also helps explain the diversity of Nepenthes, as many of the highland species are extremely endemic and only found on one or a few mountains. A few are even microendemics that are only known from one or a handful of populations of a few hundred to a few thousand individuals. The environments inhabited by Nepenthes are as varied as the species. Of the minority of species that grow in the lowlands, none are found under the dense canopies of unbroken rainforest, although a few grow along the open edges or in gaps where vegetation is regenerating. A number of species grow as epiphytes in the upper canopy of lowland rainforest trees, where the sunlight is direct and strong. At somewhat higher elevations, where the trees generally top off at around 30 meters in height, Nepenthes may grow as epiphytes along forest edges or terrestrially where the trees are sparse and sunlight is strong, such as along ridgelines. Still higher in the upper montane forests between 2,400 and 2,900 meters in elevation, Nepenthes occur as epiphytes on trees that only reach heights of 10 meters or so, or grow terrestrially on the ground. Upper montane forests, which are also called cloud forests, usually receive around 100 inches of rain or more a year, but may get up to 230 inches of rain. Soils are peaty and thin, and there's a copious amount of precipitation that leaches out what few nutrients are present. It is in these cloud forests that Nepenthes achieve their greatest diversity. Above 2,900 meters in elevation, trees are replaced by scrub, and temperatures often swing wildly from 85 degrees during the day down to 40 degrees at night, Fahrenheit. Cloud cover is often reduced at such high elevation, so sunlight is strong and unfiltered. Only a handful of Nepenthes occur in this extreme environment, although they are present there. Other habitats where Nepenthes can be found include exposed cliff faces and seasonally dry fields and savannas. Most Nepenthes capture insects, usually whatever happens to be abundant in the area, walking or flying past the traps. Most have rather generalized pictures, like I described a bit ago, although they can vary in size and shape. Some have light windows that confuse insects into flying into them, similar to Cephalotus and some other groups like Darlingtonia that we'll talk about later. A few have become specialized on specific food sources. Nepenthes albomarginata, for example, has a ring of white trichomes around the mouth of the pitchers, hence the name albo, white, and marginata, margin. These trichomes are attractive to termites, so when a foraging column of termites finds a pitcher, many individuals fall into the pitcher while they strip the hairs off, which usually takes around 3 hours. Another species, Nepenthes pudica, which was only described 4 days ago on the 23rd of June, only produces lower pitchers that occur underground and is apparently specialized on trapping ants and other soil-dwelling invertebrates. While most Nepenthes catch insects, a few have evolved away from carnivory, although they still catch the occasional insects. Nepenthes raja, the king pitcher plant and largest yet known species, have enormous pitchers that can hold up to 3.5 liters of liquid and are known to trap lizards and small mammals such as rats, although this is a rare event. The pitchers emit a fruity smell and secrete a substance that attracts tree shrews and native rats. One study found that the pitchers are visited by a mammal on average every 4.2 hours and that the pitchers collect rat feces. So they're actually specialized at collecting rat poo, and the occasional rat falls in through their own misadventures.
That is, like, imagine if an outhouse ate people.
Yeah.
Like if that was a D&D character.
An outhouse that subsists off your poo, and occasionally you fall in and drown.
Right. And occasionally you just are like, oh, whoops, curse splash.
I'm going to slip.
That sounded like we were like toying with the play, like, oh, what am I going to do?
I mean, I kind of want to run a D&D campaign where there's like a mimic that is an outhouse now that tries to eat you. That seems like it would be cool.
You're welcome, Dungeon Masters of the audience.
If anybody runs an outhouse monster, please let me know. Another species, Nepenthes lowii, has hourglass-shaped pitchers with a wide open mouth and an upturned lid. It secretes the substance that is attractive to tree shrews and also collects their feces, although it also collects bird droppings as well, as it looks like a nice perch for birds. Finally, Nepenthes ampullaria is odd among the genus, as it is a squat plant with short tubby pitchers and small recurved lids. The plants produce extensive mats of lower pitchers along the ground that are often so filled with leaves that they don't catch any insects, and they produce few, if any, upper pitchers. So they are thought to have evolved away from carnivory to collecting and feeding on plant detritus that falls from the canopy. Nepenthes have the best documented and most diverse set of inquilines and associated life, with dozens of species known from multiple trophic levels, many of which are only known from Nepenthes pitchers and are likely obligate users of the plants. Still, there are many species of Nepenthes that have been investigated only a little or not at all, so further investigation will likely only add to the complexity that's already known. Flies, the order Diptera, account for 85% of all known inquilines, almost entirely larvae that leave the plants when they mature, so things like mosquitoes and midges, aquatic fly larvae. One study recorded 130 different fly species, of which fully 77% were not known to occur in other habitats. Mosquitoes are prominent, as might be expected in a liquid-filled pitcher, but many other groups of flies live in them as well, including non-biting midges, biting midges, phantom midges, dark-winged fungus gnats, forage flies, and flower flies. Lepidoptera, the moths and butterflies, are represented by a handful of species that live in the pitcher fluid. Some of these apparently live inside the pitcher without harming the plants, but at least one feeds on the pitcher tissue and causes clear patches, although it doesn't chew completely through the pitcher and allow the fluid to drain out.
Just want to say, insects, undefeated world champions. Every time a plant comes up with something, the insects counter. Like, the fact that you're talking about carnivorous plants and then you're like, but actually there's some insects who are like, I don't know, looks like free real estate to me. It's pretty impressive.
This acidic habitat seems great, guys.
Yeah. I'm going to move out of my parents' house and live in this plot. Like, you can't stop me.
Several species of mites are known to live in the Nepenthes pitchers, some of which walk along the surface across the decomposing bodies of trapped prey, while others swim through the pitcher fluid. Most arrive to the pitchers phoretically by riding on insects. A number of spiders preferentially build their webs in and around the Nepenthes pitchers and steal the prey the pitchers attract.
That was a question I wanted to ask you. Like, how often does that happen? Because we went to a greenhouse not long ago. We were buying some stuff for the garden this year. And I noticed that. I noticed some spiders posted up next to the carnivorous plant section in the greenhouse. Like, is that so? It sounds like that's a fairly common thing.
Yes. So generalist spiders will sometimes build webs in the pitchers because, you know, you've got a lot of attachment points right there. But there are some specialist species that are only found in and around carnivorous plants.
That to me is cool. Like, they figured it out. They know what's going on. And they don't fall in and get eaten.
That even better. That's a great transition. I love it. So the red crab spider usually lives under the peristome, that rim of the pitcher, and moves about the waxy interior on strands of silk. When threatened, it dives into the pitcher fluid and releases a silk drag line. So it goes down and swims among the pitcher fluid to hide. It will hide there for several minutes in the fluid and then uses the silk line to climb out. And if the silk line breaks, it itself becomes trapped in the pitcher and will die and get eaten. Many other aquatic or semi-aquatic species are also associated with Nepenthes pitchers, including dragonflies and damselfly naiads, terrestrial crabs, and frog tadpoles. However, perhaps the most interesting mutualism is between Nepenthes bicalcarata and the ant species Camponotus schmitzi. The ants colonize hollow tendrils and live on the plants. They are often found on the pitchers under the peristome and dive into the pitcher fluid in search of prey. When large prey is found, multiple ants drag it out of the fluid and dismember it and consume it. Some parts of the prey inevitably fall back into the pitcher, as well as ant droppings. One study found that pitchers that trapped large prey items can accumulate high ammonia levels that kill the pitchers and associated fauna. So by housing and feeding these ants, the plants are able to maintain the pitchers for longer by avoiding this ammonia poisoning.
Science! That plant, that's too smart. I don't like that.
It's a smart carnivorous plant.
Yeah, I mean, I know we're anthropomorphizing a bit, but I mean, it's hard not to with something like that, where you see things where it's almost actively recruiting help to combat a problem we have in our own agricultural settings, even like too high of an ammonia system. So
we should get some of these carpenter ants.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know about that one.
Since Nepenthes is a diverse genus, the conservation status of the various species varies widely. Many species are widespread and secure, but many are extremely endemic and at risk due to their small range size. Many of these are restricted to remote mountains that are difficult to access, but Nepenthes are popular horticultural plants and illegal collecting is always a threat. A few species are likely extinct in the wild due to overcollecting. That said, there are many responsible growers, so it's easy to acquire ethically grown Nepenthes. You can pick up some of the really common species for like $10 or $15. Habitat destruction is another major threat, as many of the places that Nepenthes thrive are being cut down and converted to agriculture or degraded due to legal and illegal mining. Drosseraceae, the next family, contains three genera: Drossera, which are commonly known as sundews and contain around 250 species, making it one of the most diverse clades of carnivorous plants; Dionea, which is monotypic and only contains the Venus flytrap; and Aldrovanda, which is also monotypic and only contains the water wheel plant. Sundews are flypaper carnivores that use sticky tentacles to capture prey. Because the group is diverse, the morphology and natural history of the different species is actually quite varied. Some species have long filiform leaves that are entirely covered in these sticky tentacles, while others have leaves that have a thin and bare lower half and an expanded tip that is covered in tentacles. Many species are small herbaceous plants that grow as rosettes of leaves held flat against the ground or upright into the air. Some tropical perennial sundews grow upright with the leaves only at the top and dead leaves forming a woody stem, somewhat like little miniature palm trees. Others are small, scrambling, almost vine-like plants. While most species are fairly small and some are downright tiny, pygmy sundews are rarely wider than an inch in diameter when they are fully grown. Most species are only a few inches wide or tall. A few species can get rather large, though. Drosera regia, the king sundew, is rather divergent from all other sundews in that it can grow up to heights of 28 inches tall and has a woody stem and roots. While specimens of Drosera erythrogyne, one of the scrambling vining species, can reach lengths of 9 or 10 feet. Sundews are found across much of the world, but they're not quite truly cosmopolitan as they are absent from large swaths of arid land, dense tropical forests, and a wide band that stretches from North Africa across the Arabian Peninsula and across most of Asia. The genus is thought to have originated in the southern hemisphere, where most modern diversity occurs, and dispersed from there. Australia alone accounts for 100 of the known species, while South Africa and Brazil each boast around 40 species. In warm tropical and subtropical areas that are always wet, sundews often grow as perennial evergreen herbs. Many species grow extremely quickly, reaching mature size within one season, but can live for years given the right growing conditions. In areas that experience distinct dry and rainy seasons, particularly in Australia, sundews either die back to the roots, live in annuals that pass the dry season as seeds, or grow extensive root systems that can gather enough water to survive the droughts. While sundews are primarily a tropical and subtropical group, a few species inhabit temperate bogs. Three species are widespread across Eurasian bogs and are some of the plants that captured the attention of Darwin. Those three species and an additional four species also occur in North America. Some of these temperate species grow throughout the summer and die back to hibernacula, which are winter buds of tightly packed leaves that survive the winter, while Drosera brevifolia, which occurs in the southeast, is an annual that passes the winter as seeds. Drosera rotundifolia in particular has an interesting distribution. This species has a circumboreal distribution across North America and Eurasia, except for an isolated population that is known from the highlands of New Guinea. It's unknown how this population came to be there, although it's likely that seeds or leaf propagules were somehow carried there by birds. Another likely instance of bird-mediated transportation is Drosera anglica, the English sundew, which also has a circumboreal distribution, except for a population known from Kauai in the Hawaiian Islands. While some species have broad, even hemisphere-wide ranges, many have extremely small ranges or are only known from one single population. For example, the king sundew is a relictual species that was only known from two sites in South Africa, one of which is now overgrown and apparently lacks any sundews. Drosera solaris, which has the smallest range of any sundew, is only known from a few square meters of habitat. The mucus secreted by sundews is extremely sticky and viscous, and in some species, a single droplet is able to be stretched more than 3 feet, a more than 1 million-fold increase in surface area. While it might be perceived that sundews are passive carnivores that just wait for prey to land on them, the opposite is true, as in addition to trapping prey, the mucus also exudes chemicals that attract insects, and once prey lands on the tentacles and leaves move in response to the prey. The amount of movement varies between species. In some, only the nearest tentacles bend in to touch and more firmly secure the prey, while in other species, the sticky pad or the entire leaf bend in and over the prey over the course of a few hours to envelop it. Not only does this help secure the prey, but it also allows better digestion as more digestive juices can be excreted and more leaf surface is available to absorb the resulting nutrients. This movement happens through a few different mechanisms. Fast movement happens by pumping cell contents around, which expands some cells and contracts others. Slower movement actually happens by growing the cells relatively quickly over the course of a few hours to a few days. Depending on the species, one or both types of movement may be used in different parts of the tentacle or leaf. The mechanism that underlies the extremely fast movement of snap tentacles in Drosera glandularia is not well understood, so it may utilize a different process from other sundews as well. Sundews are generalists that capture whatever insects land on or are attracted to them. Short, squat plants tend to capture more ground-dwelling insects, while taller plants tend to catch flying insects, but there do not seem to be any particular specialists as in Nepenthes. Prey tends to be fairly small, although larger plants occasionally catch large prey, such as small dragonflies. One observation from South America reported a small froglet caught by a sundew, but most species are too small to even rarely catch vertebrates. Three closely related species that occur in North Queensland, Australia, all inhabit shaded rainforest environments. As might be expected, given the trade-offs between carnivory and light, they all show reduced production of sticky tentacles and prey capture and may be evolving away from carnivory. Similar to Nepenthes, some sundews are found across wide ranges and secure worldwide, but others are threatened by habitat destruction and, in some cases, overcollection by horticulturalists due to their small range sizes.
It sounds like guys like you are kind of a problem.
So, I'm sad that you say
that. Defend yourself.
A lot of, in almost all commercially available carnivorous plants are grown in culture. Most of them are really easy to grow from seed or leaf cuttings. Everything I've got is grown from seed or leaf cuttings. The problem is in all of the really common stuff is like that, because it's easier to grow it than get wild caught stuff and ship it, or wild grown stuff and ship it across the world. The problem is where you get really rich collectors that want like that rare species and have to have it and will pay any cost to get it. Those are the times that it is an issue, because they will pay anything for somebody to go get that one. Like, they've got to have their collection. They got to catch them all. And, you know, they'll pay through the nose to get it.
When they do that. And so like you've described this, what sounds like almost a nano habitat in multiple instances with some of these, like what's their game plan after that? How do you simulate that environment from Northern Australia at your house so that you can have this cool plant?
A lot of carnivorous plants, like especially bog things. I'll talk about it a bit with the Venus flytraps that we're going to get to. It's not clear why some of these things in nature have such restricted habitats, because they often grow like in really generalized conditions once you bring them into culture, and can be really easy to grow. Venus flytraps are a great example. You can put them in like a bog garden with every other American pitcher plant and sundews and stuff, and they grow great. There's no real special requirements beyond high light and water. They don't grow everywhere that they potentially could in North America. We don't know really why they're restricted in range. So that could be happening with some of these things.
Sounds like the gifted small town kid who's just like, no, I'm cool. I'm going to stay in my hometown.
Yeah. We don't know why.
There's no strong reason why.
Yeah. And we'll talk about Venus flytraps again, like right now. But they've been introduced outside of their native range, even in North America, where they've established and taken hold. So, like, we don't know why they were where they were.
Where can you find them in the wild here?
Which? Carnivorous plants in general or Venus flytraps in particular?
Okay, both.
So, in North America, we've actually got a fair number of carnivorous plants. You have to go to the right habitats, so bogs and wetlands primarily here, because we're in the temperate areas. But if you can find those areas, you are likely to find carnivorous plants. So there is a state park that's about 8 miles from where I live, and it's got a big bog, and they have northern pitcher plants, sundews, and bladderworts. So I can go see carnivorous plants with a 20-minute drive from where I live. In the American Southeast, where you get lots of pitcher plants, it's easier. You just have to find the right habitat. The problem, again, is with all of these things is habitat destruction. Mm-hmm. Lots of these bogs have been drained for agriculture. So like something like less than 5 or 10% of bogs in the Southeast are left. We've just drained and killed them all. So there, if you find the right habitat, you can find carnivorous plants all throughout North America. Honestly, if you go to iNaturalist and look up sundews, I bet you can find some that are reasonably close to where you live.
Is it illegal to like just dig them up and take them?
Depends on state law. Venus flytraps are federally protected or will be. They're going to be being considered for scheduling in the Endangered Species Act. Some of the American pitcher plants are scheduled, but other ones, if you find like one of the common sundews just out and about in an area that's not protected, you could dig it up if you want. The species that we have here are widely grown in horticulture, though, and are easy to grow from seeds. So I would encourage you to just get one that has been grown for that purpose instead of getting them from the wild. But I mean, hypothetically, yes, you could.
Which ones do you have?
I have a couple different American pitcher plants, a bunch of different sundews, because it turns out I really like sundews, and some butterworts and Venus flytraps. So let's talk about Venus flytraps.
Let's.
So Venus flytraps and water wheel plants are closely related monotypic groups that are sister lineages to each other and together form a sister group to the sundews. Both species have snap traps that react quickly, closing within a second of being triggered. Given their close relationship and the complicated nature of the traps, it's generally accepted that snap traps evolved only once before the two groups differentiated. Fleischman et al. Suggest that the two genera diverged around 48 million years ago, although McPherson reports that Aldrovanda pollen is known from 85 million year old deposits, so it could be a lot older than what is thought. Regardless, the two groups have been evolving separately for quite some time. Because the snap traps are sister to the sticky trap Drosera, it's thought that snap traps evolved from a sundew-like sticky trap that, in a process where the sundew-like ancestors steadily increased leaf movement speeds that help restrain and retain prey until the leaves were so fast that they didn't need the sticky mucus and the mucus was lost. In both groups, the traps consist of semicircular lobes that are borne on a long petiole, the stem part of leaves and other plants. The lobes are convex when held open, but pop to being concave when closed, and this helps with some of their speed. However, beyond possessing snap traps, Venus flytraps and water wheel plants have very different morphologies and natural histories. And even the traps themselves are quite different once you look past their general morphologies. Venus flytraps are terrestrial and grow in open and sunny, waterlogged, perpetually wet, nutrient-poor acidic areas, including peat bogs, wet savannas, seepage areas, and depressions in flat pine forests. Despite having habitat requirements that are similar to many other carnivorous plants, they are only naturally found in a small area of North and South Carolina and about 120-mile radius centered around Wilmington on the coast of North Carolina, although naturalized populations occur in northern Florida, New Jersey, England, and New Zealand. Within their native range, Venus flytraps are threatened by extensive habitat degradation and destruction and are currently being considered being listed as endangered by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Venus flytraps grow as rosettes of leaves that radiate out from an underground rhizome. The traps are up to an inch long and half an inch wide and grow on a petiole that is up to 2.5 inches long, so it can catch prey about the size of a house fly or slightly larger. Each trap has three trigger hairs that, if two are depressed 20 seconds apart, or if one is depressed twice in rapid succession, cause the trap to close within 0.5 to 1 second, quite fast and dramatic movement for a plant. The trap movement is likely caused by cell growth. Specifically, it's thought that the cells on the outside of the trap pump hydrogen ions into their cell walls. This acidifies the cell walls, which loosens the cell wall fibers and allows the cells to grow quickly via osmosis. Because the traps close via cell growth, they become sluggish and slow the more times they are triggered and can only close somewhere between 3 and 12 times before they can't close anymore. And because the traps have a limited number of uses, they continue to detect movement against the trigger hairs once the trap is triggered. If the prey is small and escapes, the trap stops cell growth and opens again within 12 hours. But if the prey is large and continues to move the trigger hairs, the trap grows, seals shut, and begins the digestion process. Because they live in wet environments, Venus flytraps are occasionally inundated during floods. The traps can function underwater and have been known to catch aquatic invertebrates such as flatworms. Similar to Cephalo's pitcher plants, Venus flytraps can become overgrown by other vegetation. While they prefer to have less than 25% shade, plants can survive in up to 45% shade. Under such conditions, the plants don't produce seed and have weak foliage, but may persist for years until a fire clears away the competing plants or a tree fall creates a break in the canopy. Venus flytraps grow slowly and take 5 to 7 years to develop from seed to mature plants, so unsustainable harvest by collectors, combined with their small geographic range and destruction of bog habitats for farmland and other uses, continues to threaten the species in the wild. They're easy to grow in cultivation as they produce seed well and can be propagated vegetatively from leaves and rhizome divisions, so harvesting wild populations is unneeded even for the popular demand for a species that's found in just about every garden center. Waterwheel plants are rootless aquatic plants that float on the edges of slightly acidic ponds, lakes, pools, and river deltas where sunlight and carbon dioxide are high but nutrients are low. The plants are poor competitors and die out if surrounding vegetation becomes too dense or high or if algae becomes prolific. They are native to the Old World and were historically widespread but patchily distributed, having been found across Eastern Europe, parts of Western Europe, and patches across tropical Africa, the Himalayan foothills, Japan, and parts of coastal Australia. Up to 17 fossil species are recognized, with the oldest dating to the Cretaceous, so waterwheel plants are considered a relictual species whose range is defined more by the loss of where they used to occur. The plants consist of a stem that grows a whorl of 5 to 9 leaves at a node, with up to 19 nodes per plant. Older segments of the plants die off as new segments grow, so each floating stem grows up to 8 inches. Stems occasionally bifurcate, so as the plants grow, the split travels down the stem until the stem dies up to the division, and then the two branches become two plants. Most population growth occurs via this asexual division, with seed production being relatively uncommon. However, it also means that just a single waterwheel plant is capable of colonizing a new habitat if it is transported there, for example, via duck feet. This may account for some of the patchiness of the species range. Because waterwheel plants are aquatic, the traps are limited by water resistance and so are much smaller than Venus flytraps, being only about 1/4 inch long. They have up to 40 trigger hairs and, unlike Venus flytraps, can close in as little as 0.01 seconds, the fastest plant movement known.
I didn't want to interrupt and I was trying to wait. I was looking for a natural break, but just to reestablish here for 1 second. You're saying the primary way that these plants are spread are by duck's feet.
Yeah. The primary way that waterwheel plants are spread is probably via aquatic birds. Ducks being one of them.
Specifically but, duck. Okay.
Ducks are a go-to, but yeah, aquatic birds are probably picking these plant propagules up and moving them from place to place.
And how was that established? Did it involve ducks as part of a research project?
You know, I don't know. Honestly, I think it's just like, how else are they going to move there? They don't hardly produce seed at all. Almost all populations are genetic clones of each other. In places where there is a lot of good habitat, maybe the seeds can blow from one place to another. But like,
right.
You know, other things are carried around by birds.
I'm just imagining the like clickbaity headlines of clonal plants that eat flesh carried around by waterfowl, or, you know, like it seems science fiction-y.
It's not as majestic as you would have thought.
I don't know.
Like these like clumsy ducks.
Right. So the traps can close in as little as 0.01 seconds, the fastest plant movement known. The precise mechanism of trap closure is not known, but wrinkles are present in open traps that are lacking in closed traps. So it may be that the traps are held open like springs and close mechanically when triggered, similar to trap jaw ant mandibles, which close faster than is possible via muscle movement alone. Because the traps are small, waterwheel plants usually catch small aquatic prey such as Daphnia. However, they also catch larger prey such as mosquito larvae, which dangle out of the trap while the bits that are inside the trap are partially digested. Waterwheel plants are extremely sensitive to pollution and habitat disturbance, so unfortunately, they have been extirpated from Western Europe and Bangladesh and are endangered in Eastern Europe. Populations in Australia have declined, although they can still be abundant in undisturbed areas of bush habitat. Recent surveys have not been undertaken in Africa, the Middle East, or China, but it is likely that they are also in decline or extirpated in those areas, given their sensitivity to habitat change. Conversely, water wheel plants are not native to North America, and in a strange twist, introduced populations in New York State are expanding and may be invasive. The remaining two carnivorous Nepenthales are also monotypic genera with single species each. Drosophyllum lusitanicum, commonly called the dewy pine, and Triphyophyllum peltatum, which has no common name. These two species form a group with some non-carnivorous plants sister to the DNDD clade, so it's not clear if carnivory was just lost independently in the non-carnivorous groups or lost once and then re-evolved, as either could have happened based on the phylogeny. Dewy pines are sticky trap plants that are superficially similar to sundews, especially king sundews, hence the name. Drosophyllum, Drosera, they have the same base, but they're not closely related. Dewy pines are perennial plants that have woody stems and erect linear leaves up to 8 inches long that form a rosette. The leaves are covered by sticky glands, but the leaves do not move in response to prey, as in sundews. Dewy pines are found in Portugal, southern Spain, and adjacent Morocco across the Strait of Gibraltar. Unlike most of the plants we've discussed, dewy pines thrive in dry, rocky soils. They require sandstone or silicate rocks, so despite the widespread existence of similarly dry, rocky habitats around the Mediterranean, they can't survive in the alkaline limestone-based soils present elsewhere. The habitats in which dewy pines grow consist of sparsely vegetated low heath or scrub habitat. The roots of dewy pines are extensive and very fine, as the plants require a lot of water uptake in an arid environment to maintain the sticky mucus, so specimens generally die when their roots are disturbed. This has led to the perception that they can be difficult to cultivate, as wild specimens that are dug up or seen grown specimens that are repotted die within a season. However, they're relatively easy to grow from seed and have been grown vegetatively from leaf cuttings. They're still relatively uncommon in cultivation, but most species available are grown from cultured plants rather than wild specimens, which is nice for a change. Similar to other carnivorous plants, the biggest threat to dewy pines are habitat loss, especially due to the increase in eucalyptus plantations in Portugal and Spain, combined with the small and fragmentary nature of their natural range. Triphyophyllum, which I think might be my favorite genus name to be saying right now, just rolls off the tongue, Triphyophyllum, are native to a small area of Sierra Leone, the Ivory Coast, and Liberia in Western Africa. They prefer primarily rainforest with dappled sunlight and acidic, leached, nutrient-poor soils with little to no organic matter. Too much or too little sunlight inhibits growth. Triphyophyllum have three distinct types of leaves during their growth, hence the tri in the name. The first leaves are non-carnivorous, narrow, and long, borne on an upright stem. After around 2 years of growth, the plant switches to carnivorous leaves, which are narrow, linear, and covered with stalked mucus glands. These glandular leaves resemble those of dewy pines, and only three living carnivorous leaves are ever produced at a time. Eventually, a third type of leaf, which is also non-carnivorous, long and narrow and has hooks at the end, is produced. When this happens, the plant begins to grow as a long vine that can reach up to 150 feet in length as it winds its way in and through the canopy. Production of carnivorous leaves was once thought to be a necessary step to jumpstart vine growth, but recent observations of carnivorous leaves produced by mature vines amongst the tertiary hooked leaves does not support this idea. In wild plants, carnivorous leaves are produced during some years, but not others, so it's not clear what triggers their production. It's also not clear what they're needed for, beyond the general idea that they're likely supplementing the plant with some key nutrient that isn't found in the leached soils that it grows in. Triphyophyllum are really rare in cultivation. It's only been grown in three greenhouses that are open to the public, as you can imagine, for a vine that can get up to 150 feet in length. And it's not well known how secure their populations are in the wild. So before I get too long in the tooth, I'd like to stop here and wrap up today's episode. The next major jump in the plant tree of life will take us into the order Ariacales, which includes the American pitcher plants and their fascinating insect associates. We also still have to talk about two novel trap types, bladder traps, and lobster pot traps, a group that doesn't produce digestive enzymes but relies instead on mutualist assassin bugs that feed on trapped insects and poop on the plant leaves, and another newly described genus that was only discovered to be carnivorous within the last few years. So before we sign out, John and Jody, do you have any final thoughts, questions, comments?
Go get some of those wheel ones on your feet and spread them around. Don't leave it all up to the ducks.
Except they're not native here. Don't do that if you're in here.
Don't do that.
Do that if you're in Europe, not North America. Sorry, Jody, what were you saying?
I was like, okay, so like if we're in Europe, we can put some like flippers on and like flop around like ducks.
You could also just pick them up and move them with your human hands.
Wrong. Incorrect. You said it was feet transmitted.
They actually grow really easily in culture if you have an aquarium set up. I had one as a teenager. They were quite fun. They're just really sensitive to change, water change.
What have you been reading to help build this script?
So I have a couple of resources. One is a two-volume set by, what's his first name? Stuart McPherson, Carnivorous Plants and Their Habitats, Volumes 1 and 2. I'll show you here. They are quite hefty books. They're for the audio.
Well struck.
I actually got them. You guys might appreciate this. I bought them when they first came out and bought the signed author editions. So I've got Mr. McPherson's signatures in both my books. He writes very well in these, and I'm getting probably 80% of the very specific information from it. I'm also relying on Ellison and Adamek, 2017, Carnivorous Plants, Physiology, Ecology, and Evolution. It's an edited volume, so each of the chapters has a different author, but there's chapters like the evolution of carnivory and angiosperms, systematics and evolution of Sericinaceae. It's got chapters on just about everything that you want. So for some of, especially the specific phylogenetic stuff, I'm pulling a lot from that set of papers as well, and it's really well written.
Jonathan, do you have any carnivorous plants?
I don't.
Yeah.
I think our office tried to have one and they put it in a terrarium and I don't think it lived. Now I just look in the terrarium thing and I see like a plastic dinosaur. So I feel like Mike's telling me that we can keep these alive. It's easy to keep, but they seem pretty difficult.
So you can grow them in terrariums and lots of people do. So you have to think like a carnivorous plant. They like high light, they like high humidity, and they don't like anything in their water. So in terrariums, you typically have to grow them with grow lights because they indoors don't ever get enough light. If you have a really sunny windowsill, we've got an east-facing, southeast-facing bathroom window that I can grow some carnivorous plants on, but not all. It gets enough light for certain plants, but not enough for others. But generally, if you're growing plants indoors, they have to have high-powered grow lights for like 8 to 12 hours a day. The other issue is they don't like anything in their water. So most tap water has too many minerals in it for carnivorous plants. If you use tap water, it will kill the plants within a few months as the minerals accumulate in the soil that you use. So most people use reverse osmosis water or rainwater. They'll have a rain barrel outside and collect that. Ideally, you want to have a TDS meter, a total dissolved solids meter. It measures the total dissolved solids in your water. They're like $10 to $15 on Amazon. They're real cheap. And you want to have water that has a TDS of less than 50, and most tap water is anywhere from 150 to 200, so it just kills the plants. So you need to have like water that has nothing in it. Fortunately for me, I've got a creek that runs through my backyard, and I measured the TDS in there, and it's somewhere between 30 and 50, depending on the day. And so I just go get buckets of creek water because it works really well for me. If you have a dehumidifier, that also typically has really low TDS because it's pulling water straight out of the air, so it's basically zero. But if you don't have those kind of things, it can be like a lot of people will install a reverse osmosis system because that's the only way to get water that works.
These are all fantastic tips.
The other thing is the planting medium. So you can't plant them in just regular old potting soil that's got way too many nutrients in it. You need to use like peat, sphagnum peat, particularly straight sphagnum moss. And usually it has to be cut with something like perlite or sand to make it lighter and airier. So you want to have something that has no nutrients in the planting medium at all and is well drained. Again, if you know the requirements, it's easy to do and it's not expensive, but if you treat them like regular old houseplants, you'll kill them every time.
I had to like go in and just look. I had to look at pictures while you were talking. So
I tried.
I was like trying to like frantically type in what you were talking about so I could see them. And see,
I know like, I tried going back and forth, but it really threw me off when I was reading the script. And so I just kind of stopped. So okay.
Those sundews are really cool.
Right?
They're so cool. They're so like visually just beautiful. And they look like a bunch of paddles with these little tentacles. Like you just think like a sticky hand or just so sticky. And I hate being sticky. So like seeing it, it's beautiful to look at, but I also get this feeling like, ugh, like I like that looks really sticky.
Most of them are really small.
And I see it's cool.
So if you want to grow carnivorous plants, a good place to start are Cape sundews. They're native to, I guess, the Cape of South Africa. They are really, they need low TDS water, like all carnivorous plants. But they're really forgiving of a lot of things. They're often grown on windowsills. I've got one that came in. I bought some plants and it was like an extra that just self-seeded in the plug with the plant that I bought. So I pulled it out and started it. And now I've got a Cape sundew. It's growing not in a terrarium. It's just in an open pot on my windowsill in the bathroom. The kids taking showers every day that puts enough humidity into the air it gets enough sun on that southern southeastern window that it just does just fine.
Does it get enough flies and stuff?
Have not a huge issue with dark winged fungus gnats, but I get some of them that fly out of my hissing cockroach colony.
Oh, I was gonna say you still have a drain problem. Remember when you had a drain fly problem?
I got drain flies sometimes. No, they come out of the cockroach colony. And so I'll be sitting here at the computer and like one will fly past my face and I'll smack it and then take it in and use a pair of forceps to like feed my sundews, mm-hmm. the dead fungus gnats that are coming out of my cockroaches.
Totally normal sense.
Totally normal thing for somebody to do.
Yeah. Well, I know I miss my black widow spider for the purpose of not killing the flies and then feeding the alive flies to it. Now I'm like, oh, now you have to die for nothing.
You should get another black widow.
I know. I need some more grapes.
Any other thoughts before you wrap it up? I hope it's not too boring kind of doing this like walk through the carnivorous plants, but each one of them does like different stuff and is, I think, fascinating and interesting.
I like this tour through your mental herbarium.
We'll wrap it up next time with finishing off the various carnivorous plants, getting to some of my favorites, the American pitcher plants and things like butterworts and corkscrew plants. With that, you can find us on the web at arthro-pod.blogspot.com and on Twitter at @arthro_podshow. You can find me, Michael Scavarla, on Twitter at mscavarla36.
I'm at Bugman John.
And I'm at Jody Bugsme, UNL.
It's time for our insect heroes to put away their nets and pheromone traps. Join us next time, same bug time, same bug channel, as the Arthropod Gang make the world safe from poor insect podcasts. Until then,
keep on bugging. "Wretch," I cried, "thy God hath lent thee. By these angels he hath sent me. Respite, respite, and nepenthe from thy memories of Lenore. Quaff, oh, quaff this kind nepenthe, and forget this lost Lenore," quoth the raven.
Nevermore.
Yeah, I was hoping you would do that.